Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show tonight, my conversation with trumpeter, composer, record mogul, and visual artist Herb Albert. And the Canadian singer-songwriter Doug Paisley performs in our studio. But we'll start with your memories of the late Pete Seeger. The music icon, songwriter, and activist died on Monday in New York at age 94. And since then, we've been asking you for your Pete Seeger stories, the time you met him or were influenced by his work. You can check out all the great tales that have been posted on soundcheck.org, and we'll kick tonight's show off with a few more. Our listener Raina marks Pete Seeger's passing this way. May the circle be unbroken. We're very lucky to have had his wisdom, energy, and perseverance in our world. And here's a message from Amala from Washington Heights, who saw Seeger perform about 15 years ago at a National Conference of Quakers held in Oklahoma.
I remember one of the things he did was demonstrate what he did to keep fit. You know, saying I had a hammer, and then he sang a work song, and with his young guitarist, swung some hammers and hammered nails into a log. And he did it. I think he was in his late 70s, early 80s, and he never missed anything. And the young guy was huffing and puffing after him and couldn't quite keep up.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land.
Lots of people identified Seeger with his song, If I Had a Hammer. Here's Karen Frillman, an editor in the WNYC newsroom, who also happens to be Pete Seeger's neighbor.
People would give Pete things because they felt connected to him. And he had various ceremonial plaques with hammers attached to them in reference to his, If I Had a Hammer, his great song. And so at times, Pete, if he was looking around, he would grab the hammer off one of these plaques. And one time, you know, he picked it up and it was just a ceremonial hammer and he was very, very frustrated. What good is this thing?
This is not a real hammer.
If I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning.
There's a common thread running through some of these stories on soundcheck.org. Many of you were children when you first encountered Pete Seeger.
Everyone, hey, hey, skip to Malou, hey, hey, skip to Malou, hey, hey, skip to Malou, skip to Malou, my darling.
McLean from Brooklyn writes, when I was five, my father and I saw Pete Seeger on a Metro North train out of Manhattan. I still have the autograph he gave me. He wrote, don't let schooling get in the way of your education. Juliana met Pete Seeger when she was about 6 years old. It was a boring grown-up party, she writes, with only a few other kids and a tempting swimming pool. We really wanted to go in, but the grown-ups kept saying no. Mr. Seeger heard our plaintive begging, came over to me and whispered in my ear, just do it. And we did. Once we were in, we were in. Pete Seeger, subversive and sweet. Here's Michael from Greenpoint, who invited the folk singer to perform at an Earth Day celebration in 2009.
During his playing, he invited this little girl that kept pulling on his pant leg while he was trying to play, and he picked her up and put her on his lap while he sang his music, and it was very touching.
Now, as you kids got older, Pete Seeger's music served a different purpose. I spoke with Nora Guthrie, the daughter of another folk music legend, Woody Guthrie. She said Pete Seeger was like a second father to her. Here's a story from Nora.
I was 12 years old. I'm sorry, this is going to be a funny story. I was 12 years old, and a boy that I was going to camp with sat down and serenaded me on guitar with The Water Is Wide.
The water is wide, I cannot get over, and neither have I wings to fly.
He had learned that from Pete. and I immediately fell in love with the boy because the song was so beautiful. And I have to laugh because in retrospect, how many people not just marched with Pete and protested with Pete, but fell in love to Pete Seeger's music.
Yeah.
He was, a real Cupid.
When I was a young man and never been kissed, I got to thinking over what I had missed. I got me a girl, I kissed her and then, oh Lord, I kissed her again.
Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.
Nora Guthrie visited Pete Seeger just before he died. She and her daughter sang Hobo's Lullaby, a song recorded by both her dad, Woody Guthrie, and Pete Seeger. And he lay listening to Nora and her daughter from his hospital bed.
I feel like there was this huge connection between where he was going and my dad and Cisco and Leadbelly and Sonny Terry and everybody that's up there waiting for him, because he's the leader, you know. They're all musicians, but Pete was the leader.
So you're saying the music in heaven just got a little bit better today?
Oh, my God. It got like, organized, you know. They're all great musicians, but Pete was always the one, whether it was in the Almanac Singers or the Weavers or anything, Clearwater, everything he's done, he's been the captain at the helm of the ship.
Oh, we shall
Pete Seeger stories and share one of your own by going to soundcheck.org or leaving us a message at 866-939-1612. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, trumpeter and songwriter Herb Alpert was in town. Yes, that Herb Alpert, the man behind the Tijuana Brass and A&M Records and the Herb Alpert Awards. He was here in New York, though, to install his Spirit Totem sculptures. We met near Lincoln Center at P.J. Clark's, a restaurant across from Dante Park, where the night before, he and a crew had spent 3 polar vortex-chilled hours installing his large black bronze works. And as we settled into a booth, I started out by asking Herb Alpert when he started doing visual art. So first of all, Herb, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let me ask you about the sculptures that are in now 2 different parts of the city, the totems here across from Lincoln Center and the other sculptures that are at the ACA Gallery. When did you start doing visual art?
Well, gee whiz, that goes back a ways. You know, I started painting about 45 years ago. When I was traveling around the world with the Tijuana Brass, I used to go to museums and go to the modern art section, and I kind of gravitated towards abstract art. And I had kind of an interesting afternoon once. I was looking at this black painting with a purple dot, you know, hanging in a museum. I was thinking, black painting with a purple dot. I think I could try something like that. So I grabbed some, when I got home, I grabbed some paints and canvas, and I started... I bought some acrylic paint, and I started painting like a monkey, you know, just kind of moving it around with my fingers and trying to come up with an interesting color combination and rhythm. And I started, you know, finding stuff that I kind of liked. And I had this one painting that I thought was really cool. I mean, it really had a, I thought had a feel for it. I hung it up on my wall, and overnight, it disappeared. I forgot to, you know, prime the canvas. I didn't know about priming canvas. And I watered down the acrylic with water, so it kind of like just seeped its way into the canvas, and I kind of all but lost the painting. And then from that point on, I said, man, I better get a little bit of technique before I venture on. So, you know, I started little by little, you know, just working it and having fun doing it. I wasn't doing it for any other reason than having fun.
Well, now, you know, 45 years ago, you would have been at the height of your sort of pop music fame.
No, not really. It was like in 1970, so that gives us, like it's 44 years, actually.
44 years, yeah.
I was going through a divorce. I was having trouble playing the trumpet. I was looking for another outlet, and that's how that came about.
Because the years prior to that had seen you and the Tijuana Brass with just hit after hit after hit, and A&M Records was rolling along, and it just... So at this point, at what should be the apogee of your career, you found you couldn't play the trumpet anymore?
I couldn't have fun playing the trumpet. I was going through a divorce, and I was tight. You know, my neck was tight, my back was tight, my stomach didn't feel good, and I started getting into some bad habits playing the trumpet. All of a sudden, I started stuttering through the horn.
Wow.
And I couldn't get the first note out right.
Wow.
So it was an emotional problem. And, little by little, I worked it out with the help of a trumpet teacher here in New York by the name of Carmine Caruso, who, oddly enough, never played trumpet a day in his life. But he was a famous, they called him a troubleshooter for brass musicians.
A fixer.
He was a fixer, and he, you know, analyzed different problems that he treated each one as an individual problem. And what he did was he likened the musician to the athlete. And instead of teaching music, he taught the physics of playing the instrument. And that's what I learned from him. And it took a while, but little by little, you know, I got my mojo working again.
Yeah. We're speaking with Herb Alpert, legendary trumpeter and composer, co-founder of A&M Records, here at P.J. Clark's, which has seen its share of artists over the years. Just across the street from the three large sort of totemic sculptures that have been installed at Dante Park, they're sort of like abstract versions of totems. But, you know, there's a little part here that looks like a horse's head and something over there that maybe looks like two dolphins or, you know, I mean, I guess like jazz or any other form of instrumental music where there aren't words to tell you what to think, this sort of enables the viewer to figure out what it means.
Yeah, I think that personally that's the beauty of abstract art. I was always curious about what is that thing that makes something engaging to look at? You know, what makes that thing that's engaging to listen to, you know, music? And if you think too hard about it, if you try to analyze, you know, a piece of art, I think you kind of miss the point. Art should resonate in the soul, and music should resonate not in the ears, but in the soul as well. A lot of abstract art is, you kind of fill in the missing parts as you're watching it. And it means different things to different people. I often cite the idea that if you're walking down the beach and with 10 people and you pick up a piece of driftwood, all 10 people will say, "Wow, that's beautiful, isn't that? That's a work of art, man. Who you can, you know, you can't improve on that." But you know, you take a sculpture or a painting, you know, and bring 10 people in front of it that had never seen it before. And, you know, 5 might say, "That's pretty good." 3 might say, "Are you kidding me?" And 2 would say, "I can do that."
As you did with the black painting with the purple dot.
Yeah, I don't want to make light of that black painting, but, I mean, that did inspire me.
Yeah. Herb, your most recent album, Steppin' Out, It sort of continues a long-standing trend towards instrumental music for you, although obviously with Lanny Hall, your wife, being a singer, you've done vocal works as well. But is there something analogous in instrumental music to the kind of painting and sculpture that you do?
Well, I think there's a connection for sure. But, you know, I like melodies. It feels like the last several years we got away from melodies. We're hearing music on the radio that we can't hum back. Not that that's a criteria for good music, but I like, you know, those old things that kind of creep into your bones. And before A&M Records, you know, I used to play in bands, and I had this backlog of songs, maybe 2,000-3,000 songs in my head that I used to play, you know, without music, just they'd name a song and I'd play it. So every now and then one of those songs creep up into my memory and I find myself whistling it. And what I've tried to do with the albums that I've recorded recently is to take familiar songs and give them a new twist. So, like, you're hearing a song that was maybe famous years back, but you're not hearing it in the same way. I'm putting a little spin on it to make it fresh.
So we've got some original composition, but also songs, standards from the Great American Songbook.
Right, and that lead song, Puttin' on the Ritz, which has had over a million hits on YouTube, is a great example of a wonderful song that was written in the 30s by one of the great of all time, Irving Berlin.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we hear that version of Puttin' on the Ritz from Herb Alpert's latest album called Steppin' Out. Of Steppin' Out, the latest album from the trumpeter and composer Herb Alpert, the co-founder of A&M Records, sculptor and painter as well, and Puttin' on the Ritz from this album that Herb, as we sit here now, is nominated for a Grammy Award in the category of Best Pop Instrumental Album. Now, people are hearing this after the Grammys, so I'm going to ask you two questions. One is
did I win?
How do you feel about winning? And the other is, how do you feel about not winning? And you can choose which one you want to answer first.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm going to give you the obvious answer, and I feel good just being nominated because I won my first Grammy 48 years ago. You know, that Whipped Cream and Other Delights. I think some people might remember that one. And just to be nominated again is a great feeling. So win or lose, it's okay by me.
The fact that you're still being nominated in the pop category, you know, is a kind of a tribute to not just being able to keep a finger on the pulse of what pop music is, but you've had a big hand in kind of shaping the direction of American pop music. I mean, A&M Records, you guys came out of the box so fast. Lonely Bull was the first.
Right, Lonely Bull was A&M's first record, and it took a while before A&M connected, actually. But when we did, you know, little by little, it really started growing. You know, we picked up a record, I think, in 1967 was We Five, You Were On My Mind, which became a number one record.
I got trouble. I got
'66, we signed Sergio Mendes in Brazil, '66.
Other notes are bound to follow, but the root is still that note. Now this new one is a consequence of a one we've just been through, as I'm bound to be the unavoidable consequence of you. There's so many people who can talk and talk and talk and just say nothing, or nearly nothing. I have used up all the skill I know, and at the end I've come to nothing. Nearly nothing, so I come back to my first note, as I must come back to you. I will pour into that one note all the love I feel for you.
Now, A is you, Herb Alpert. M is Jerry Moss.
Right.
What was, when you guys released The Lonely Bull, was it just like, all right, here's this song, let's just get it out there? Or was there some master plan?
Well, actually, there was no master plan. In fact, A&M was not our first name that we chose as a record label. It was Carnival Records. And we found that there was prior usage of that name, so we had to... We put five names together. I think A&M was like the third one on the list, but that was the one that cleared. Lonely Bull was a result of me going to bullfights. Actually, my partner Jerry Moss was with me several times. Used to go in the springtime to Tijuana and hear this brass band in the stands. You know, it wasn't a mariachi band. It was just a little brass band, and they play these fanfares for each individual event, and ba-da, ba-ba-da, ba-da, ba-da, ba. That, I would hear that often. And I went home and tried to capture the feeling of the afternoons that I spent there. Recorded the song. It was originally called Twinkle Star. It was a little cute little ditty written by a friend of mine, Saul Lake, who was a piano player. Didn't sound like The Lonely Bull, but I loved that melody, so we recorded it. Played it for a disc jockey friend of mine, and he said, well, where's the hook? I said, what do you mean the hook? He says, you need a hook, man. I said, I don't know about hooks, you know. He says, you need something you can hum, something you can remember, something to retain, blah, blah, blah. And so I called an engineer friend that I knew, Ted Keeps, who was the head engineer at Liberty Records, and he gave me a tape with 30,000 people screaming Olé on it. And so we put that right in the front. So, you know, at the fanfare, and then there's that crowd yelling, yep, Olé. And then I played it. We did that, and I played it for my disc jockey friend. He says, man, you got a hook. This is good. Record happened in 3 days. It was like huge. It was, we were getting calls from distributors all over the country and different parts of the world, and we were all of a sudden on a roll. We were on such a roll that I got a call from a distributor we hired in Washington, D.C. He says, man, you guys got a smash. That Acapulco 1922 is a monster. I said, man, you're on the wrong side. So, you know what I mean? When the door opens and you get lucky, things start rolling.
In a moment, we'll be back with more from the legendary bandleader and record label founder Herb Alpert, who just picked up his 7th Grammy this weekend for his album, Steppin' Out. And stay tuned for some live music here in our studio later in the show from the country singer whose last name is Paisley, but first name is not Brad. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we're talking with Herb Alpert, the legendary trumpeter, composer, co-founder of A&M Records, and visual artist. You can see some of his spirit totem sculptures on display here in New York in Dante Park, just across from Lincoln Center, and at the ACA Galleries in Chelsea through March 1st. We were just discussing Herb's early career as leader of the Tijuana Brass. Now, Herb, you mentioned earlier going to bullfights in Tijuana. Did people assume that you were Latin yourself?
I think so. Yeah, I think that was one of the things. I had trepidation about that name. That was my partner's idea. I had to live that down because, you know, I didn't want to feel like I was an imposter trying to, you know, get on somebody else's parade.
But you did have a genuine love for this music and, it seems, for Brazilian music.
Well, I have a general love for good music, you know. Like Duke Ellington once said, there's good music and there's bad music. So, I mean, it's all... What's beautiful about music, it's personal. You know, what might appeal to one might not appeal to another.
Right.
You know, being the head of A&M, I remember having a record that was recorded by one of our artists, and I was thinking, like, man, this is a smash. This record is destined for big things. And I'd play it for the promotional staff, and, you know, they'd be staring at the wall like nothing was happening. So, you know, it's apples and oranges.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of it. What is that thing that rings for some people and doesn't ring for others?
You know, Herb, one of the things that we do from time to time on Soundcheck is we have this kind of series called That Was a Hit, where we look at songs that actually did make it to the top of the charts, and some years later you look back and you think, how did that happen?
Yeah.
And we actually did one on your song, This Guy's in Love with You, because you were so successful as a trumpeter and a band leader, and here's the song that takes you to number one, and you're singing.
Yeah, well, that was a fluke. I'll tell you why. Because I was doing a television show for NBC, and the director, Jack Haley Jr., asked me if I would sing a song. He says, I'm tired of photographing you with, you know, the trumpet in your mouth. I said, well, if I can find the right song, I'll give it a go. So I called a friend. I have a friend by the name of Bert Bacharach. You hear him?
Gee, I think that name's vaguely familiar.
Okay, so I called Bert. I said, Bert, do you have one of those songs that, you know, you didn't get the right recording of? You have it tucked away in your drawer someplace. You find yourself whistling it in the shower, blah, blah, blah. He sent me This Girl's in Love with You. Dionne Warwick had recorded it. I liked it. I really liked the melody. I felt like I could handle it as a non-singer. And I called Hal David, who was in New York at the time, and asked him if he would change the gender and make some modifications. I told him it was for a television show. I flew to New York. He made those changes. And as I was leaving Hal's place, I asked him the same question I asked Bert, if there was one of those songs that blah, blah, blah. Well, he sent me Close to You. And after The Lonely Bull became a monster hit because of the TV show, it wasn't because the radio, you know, had its play, but it was because this TV show was popular and people wrote in. They wanted to hear more of that song. So that song zoomed to number one in 2 weeks.
Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do? When you smile, I can tell we know each other very well. How can I show you I'm glad I got to know you, 'cause I've heard some talk.
The rest of the story is, you know, I was going to record, which I did, Close to You as the follow-up.
Mm.
I recorded it, and it was a pretty good recording, and I was in the control room listening to the playback, and the engineer friend of mine, Larry Levine, he looked at me, he says, man, you sound terrible singing this song. You know,
That's a good friend.
He was a good friend. You know, I lost my fastball on that one and decided just to put it in my drawer. And, you know, signed the Carpenters in late 1969. They had not a great run for the first 8 months to a year. You know, they released records that didn't happen. And then I gave them Close to You, and the rest was history. Although the first time they recorded it, Karen was playing drums.
Uh-huh.
She was a drummer. You know, Karen with this magical voice that has thrilled millions of people around the world. Hey, Karen, what do you think you do best? Well, I think I'm a drummer.
Yeah.
That's what she would say. So they recorded it with Karen playing the drums. I heard it, and I said, no, it's a little too soft. You need a little bit more oomph in there. Yeah. They recorded it again, and it wasn't quite it. And then we got the Wrecking Crew. This is the guys from the West Coast, Hal Blaine. And
the famous band, the session
musicians.
Yeah,
the famous band that was on a lot of records. And so they backed them up on Close to You. Richard did the arrangement. And Richard is brilliant in his own right.
Richard Carpenter.
Yeah. And the song became, the door flung wide open for them, and deservedly so.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be close to you. On the day that you were born, the angels got together and decided to create a dream come true. So they sprinkled moon dust in your hair and golden starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why.
Man, you must have thought at that point, everything I touch turns to gold. I mean, your own hits, and then you're signing other people and they're having hits. And it's about this time where you began to have that block against playing, right? Right around 70?
Yeah, right around, 69 when I got the block. I don't think one thing had to do with another. It was like my partner Jerry Moss and I always felt, we were always looking for somebody who was a little left of center, an artist that had something that was a little bit different than what was on the radio. We weren't looking for the beat of the week. We were looking for the Cat Stevens of the world and the Joe Cockers and the Supertramps and those people. So, and we always gave them their opportunity to flag themselves down to the runway, and which they eventually did.
Yeah.
And so we had a roster of really amazing artists.
In addition to the ones you labeled, also The Police and Sting and so many, many
others. Oh, yeah. Well, Sting's a great example of an artist that is, he found his own voice, and he was willing to take risks and go his own direction. And, when you can do that and you're authentic like he is, you find your audience.
We're speaking with Herb Alpert on Soundcheck today. Just down the block from his three large spirit totems, which have been installed at Dante Park and are up here till like April 15th, right?
April 15th, I believe.
And
unless by popular demand people say, hey, let's move these to Lincoln Center. I'm all for that.
Well,
come
that's
on.
Just across the street. ACA Gallery has the show of your other works through March 1st. The arts have been, obviously a consistent interest of yours. I got a call from someone back in the mid-90s saying, I'm working with the Herb Alpert Foundation on a new series of awards called the Alpert Awards, and we want you to be on our nominating committee. So this was the first I had heard that you actually were getting seriously involved in this sort of effort. Tell me about how the Alpert Awards came about, what you hope to do.
Well, actually,
that.
This year is the 20th anniversary of the Alpert Awards. And I wanted to give artists that are in like mid-career, that are like pushing the envelope, people that are doing something a little, out there, a little left of center. I felt that, I had got my success as, for the most part, a commercially, charged musician, and I always admired those people that are willing to do whatever they feel like doing, just for the sake of doing it, because that's what's coming out of them naturally. And I felt like those are good people to help support.
Mm-hmm. So how are you involved in the impression I had gotten, and this was just about 20 years ago, was that you personally were not saying, all right, I'm going to pick this person, and that person.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not involved at all. Not from day one. It's just we have a staff, and it's highly organized,
mm-hmm.
and it's very kosher.
Now, you have done some great philanthropic work here in New York. I mean, basically, the foundation saved the Harlem School of the Arts. Why that? How did they get on your radar? How did that figure into?
Well, I saw an article in the paper that they were folding their tent and they were closing their doors, and I couldn't believe it, because when I thought about Harlem and the community and the artists that have come out of there, I mean, I'm not talking just about the obvious, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and James Baldwin and likes, but when I did a little research on it, I mean, Groucho Marx lived there, George Gershwin lived in Harlem, Oscar Hammerstein Jr. I mean, so it had a wealth of great artists that lived in that community, and I think, how could, you know, a place like that not exist? So, and then I visited the school. We gave them a matching fund. If they could come up with, you know, their part of the matching fund, then the money was good. And one thing led to another, and then I really got involved. I liked everybody involved, and the teachers, etc. And I'm proud to be affiliated with the Harlem School for the Arts.
Well, the Spirit Totems, just to bring this conversation back full circle, they look great here in the middle of the Upper West Side across the street from Lincoln Center. And Herb Albert, great having you with us on Soundcheck today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
That's a little more from Herb Alpert's latest album called Steppin' Out. Up next, live music from folk singer-songwriter Doug Paisley, who just might restore our faith in his hometown of Toronto. This is Soundcheck.
When the light is in your face, as the sun is coming down, when you're standing in one place, as the world goes round.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Let's talk about Toronto for a second. Now, I know the city hasn't had the best press recently, what with its crack-smoking mayor and all. But hey, there are a lot of good things about Toronto, too. The CN Tower, a world-class film festival, a great food scene, and an abundance of talented musicians. One of them is Doug Paisley, a singer-songwriter who has just released his third album called Strong Feelings. We'll talk with him in just a minute, but Doug is here with his band, and they're going to play some songs for us on Soundcheck today, beginning with this one called Song My Love Can Sing.
Always got the last word when you were broke down and you cried. And I reached out to hold you till your tears had all dried. Later you lay sleeping and I, with my eyes open wide, saying, why can't I be satisfied when love is by my side? How much farther will I go till I know? This is a song my love can sing. This is a memory from that time. For all its sadness it won't bring her back to my side. When I have not fallen too far down, I can make sense of it all. I can get to know the very moment your memory comes to call. And in the time I find myself alone, I never wonder once at all. Oh, why can't I be satisfied when love is by my side? How much farther will I go till I know? Song my love can sing. This is a memory from that time. For all its sadness it won't bring her back to my side.
That is Doug Paisley from Toronto here in our New York studio with his song, My Love Can Sing. His latest album, his third, is called Strong Feelings. It is out now. And playing with Doug today on soundcheck, David Nagler at our piano, Doug Keith on bass, Matthew Barrick behind the drum kit, and Doug Paisley, of course, playing guitar and singing and welcome, Doug.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
How often do you get called Brad?
Well, as you might expect, it does come up. In fact, Brad's father, who I believe is his road manager, his name is Doug.
Really?
So,
but you're not related?
No. Apparently there are Irish Paisleys and Scottish Paisleys, and I'm the Scottish and they're the Irish.
All right. Now, Scottish or not, are you a lifelong, what do you call a resident of Toronto, a Torontonian?
Yes, born and still being raised.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
And what is the demotic? Is it Torontoan, Torontonian? What do you call yourselves?
Well, it's changed, like as you mentioned, in the last few months, but with our current mayor. But Torontonian, I think. Yeah,
it's changed just in the last month. So now you call yourselves like Windsor or
yeah, exactly, Ottawaian or Montrealer. Yeah.
So, how much country music is there in Toronto? I mean, you're certainly not the first Canadian artist to have a country sound, Neil Young, you know, mm-hmm. some of his stuff. Mm-hmm. But is there a country music scene up north?
Definitely, yeah, yeah. And it's heavily influenced, I mean, it's, some would say derived from a lot of the American country music, but there are a lot of very big country acts and country scenes going on that are, just north of the border.
Right.
There's a famous country Canadian music legend named Stomping Tom Connors, for instance, who nobody down here would have heard of, but everyone in Canada knows him, and he's part of this big scene. So.
Stomping Tom Connors?
Stomping Tom Connors, he plays with a, he passed away recently, but he was around for decades and decades, and he played with a plywood board in which he played all of his percussion, stomping his foot while he played guitar.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's like an old Norwegian trick. All the fiddlers, they'd put like a piece of wood under their foot and provide their own accompaniment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it seems like, you know, you've had a couple of different kind of musical circles to pull from in your records. Leslie Feist mm-hmm. was on your last record.
That's right, yeah.
And Garth Hudson of the band mm-hmm. is on both the last record and on this one.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, I mean, it does in some ways tie in with the Toronto music community. I mean, they're both either active in it or associated with it.
Although Garth has lived here in New York State
for quite some time, but he originates from the Windsor area, as does the band. And so through Canadian connections, like other musicians, you know, wherein a city suddenly gets a lot smaller once you're just dealing with musicians, I hooked up with him through through other players. And he does come up to Canada. He just did a Canadian tribute to the band, actually, with Neil Young and a bunch of other Canadian bands. So he's still fairly active in Canada as well.
And so he's playing all of the keyboards, some of the keyboards?
In this particular album, he actually just did one session, which was on a Steinway piano, which belonged to Glenn Gould. It's a famous Steinway called CD318. And so he was part of this project where we went to Ottawa, where that piano is now housed. And Glenn Gould used it exclusively for almost a decade. And so that's all he plays on the album.
Is this the piano that Glenn Gould recorded? It must be that he recorded at least one of his Goldberg variations.
Well,
on.
Actually, funnily enough, it's not, because they were at the beginning and end of his career.
Right.
And the bulk of his material, which I guess is through the 60s, he spent his early career coming down to Steinway in New York and searching for the perfect piano and cursing all of their grand pianos. And then he found this one, and he used it. He was obsessed with it. I mean, some say he was an obsessive person generally, but he was obsessed with this piano. And then after a recording session, it was dropped off of a shipping dock and destroyed. And so by the end of his career, he was onto a Yamaha. Very interesting stories about him and pianos, but the bulk of his recording was done on it, and it's a very interesting piano.
Did you get to play it? Do you play the
piano? I wasn't supposed to, but we recorded from about 10 p.m. to 10 a.m., so there was a quiet lull where the security guard was asleep, and I sat down and applied my limited skills to it, and it's a very beautiful instrument.
Yeah. I mean, here in the States, even so many years after he's gone, the name Glenn Gould, especially in classical music circles, still well-known, and film circles too, because of all the documentaries about him. But man, in your neck of the woods, he must be just like huge, an icon.
Yeah, I mean, he really is ingrained in Toronto. I mean, as a record collector, it's easy to find his albums in Toronto. I mean, it's almost, I don't think people take him for granted, but he's sort of so pervasive that you know, we almost don't talk about him. We all just know, you know.
Doug Paisley talking about the late classical pianist Glenn Gould. Now, you didn't just make the pilgrimage to Glenn Gould's piano. You made another pilgrimage way farther down south to Lee Scratch Perry's place in Kingston, Jamaica. What was that for?
I'm friends with Earl Chinna Smith, who's a rhythm guitar player. If you look at most reggae records through the 70s, the odds that he isn't on it are pretty slim. He's just everywhere. And so I go down once a year, more or less, and just basically play guitar with him for a week, which is amazing. We both wear out our fingers, and leap. And his place is kind of a hub now for reggae music, so all the reggae musicians I used to listen to growing up all come through his place. And Lee Perry, we just missed him on this trip, but someone offered to take us to his studio, which is no longer active. It's essentially a hole in the ground, but it's still a fascinating place to visit. It's a concrete bunker with another raised concrete bunker, which was his control room. And you can go there. And if you want to go to Kingston, Jamaica, which not everyone does, you can go there and you can go and tour that studio. And it's about three minutes. Well, no, we were there for quite a while. His brother was the tour guide, and he sort of showed us around and spoke with us. And he's such an interesting, fascinating person, and that's reflected in this place.
And this is the place where, I mean, Bob Marley,
exactly.
but really just about every reggae or dub artist of note passed through and made records. All right, so, and you just go down there to play.
I mean, I feel like you're tempting fate when you vacation in Kingston, Jamaica, but at the same time, I feel like as long as I know this guy and can do this, I should, because I'll never go there on my own. So
does that experience ever sort of bleed into the songwriting? I mean, your songs are such a apparently sonic world away from that.
My first professional experience was playing reggae. Toronto has a huge Caribbean population, so the first bands I played in were reggae bands. I don't think I do anything near to that, and I think it's tricky to do that without being overly referential.
Yeah.
But the amount that I listen to it, I'm sure it's bound to seep in, you know, subliminally at least.
You want to play a song for us next?
Absolutely.
All right. This one's called It's Not Too Late to Say Goodbye. Doug Paisley's most recent album, his third, is called Strong Feelings. It is out now, and here's Doug once again with another live performance in the Soundcheck studio.
Thank you. You know you've hit the bottom, and your lungs are filled with cries you kept inside. Too late to say goodbye. It's not too late to say goodbye.
Doug Paisley doing his song It's Not Too Late to Say Goodbye. And Doug Paisley here in our New York studio down from Toronto. You know, Canada, United States, neighboring countries, you'd figure similar musical tastes, and certainly there are Canadian artists who are well known on our side of the border. But, you know, you were mentioning before this Stompin' Tom Connors guy, so big in your area but unknown in the States. Do you find there's a difference between Canadian audiences and American audiences?
I mean, the like Margaret Atwood, who's a famous Canadian writer, who she calls the border the world's largest one-way mirror, you know. And in that sense, I mean, Canadians are like scholars of American culture, you know. But you can go into a film, like a video store, if you can find one in Canada, and you'll find the Canadian films in the foreign section. You know,
really?
Like, I mean, that's a little extreme, but it happens, right? In terms of specific personality differences, I haven't really. I find that every crowd is its own terrifying singular beast wherever I am. So I've yet to play. Maybe with years and years of experience, I'll get all calloused and I'll be like, oh, yeah, this is a Kansas crowd or this is a Saskatchewan crowd.
What do you make of New York crowds?
New York crowds, they're. I mean, one thing that means a lot to me is people come up after the show and say hi, and people here are not shy in that way, which I really like. I don't think I've ever had a bad time playing here. I haven't had a bad time in a lot of places, but I've always had a great time playing here. I think I get excited being here, so I think that in turn informs how I play. So,
The new album, once again, called Strong Feelings, is out now. Doug, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tires is they never grow tired, rolling out open road. There's always a line that you can't seem to find. It's down the road to go. So I'll always take horses to do my work, though the pace hard to grow. And they bow down their heads in the devil's wheel.
Tomorrow on the show, actress Jessie Mueller plays a very convincing Carol King in the new Broadway musical called Beautiful. We talk with the young star about her one and only meeting with the legendary songwriter, and she'll play some songs from the show live in our studio. And we get a pick three from Nobel Prize-winning Princeton economist Paul Krugman, who also happens to be a diehard music fan. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.